On the Brink Radio. This is Jeff Phillips Wyferson coming at you from the beautiful Central Highlands of Tasmania. It's around midday on Friday, I think today's the 15th of May, something like that, 2019. This show is called The Spiritual Consequences of Humanity's War on Life. Whenever I look around, I see a very, very beautiful and improbable world of nature. So beautiful and improbable that I can't conceive of random forces of nature interacting to create the beauty of life forms, the beauty of landscapes. And I'm not really a religious person, but I am very attuned to spiritual wavelengths. And if you draw a distinction between religious behavior and a spiritual orientation, there are some relationships. But religion implies that you're sort of assimilating a pre-existing belief system that is a lot like political ideologies that sort of create mass groupings of people that profess to believe the same things. But ultimately, all of your mainstream religions, as I understand it, are really much more similar than they are different. And in the sense of how people actually live, whether you're Roman Catholic or a Protestant or a Lutheran or a Baptist or a Methodist or an Islamic or Hebrew or Zoroastrian or any of these, or even Buddhist or Taoist, in the world of today, it's pretty much not that different from how in Dr. Seuss's last book called The Butter Battle Book, the main story was there was these two peoples, these two beings called the Zooks and the Ukes, and they were absolutely identical in every single way. The only difference between them was that they buttered their bread on opposite sides. And so, however ridiculous of a difference that is, the differences between all these different world religions are really not much more than that when compared to the behavior of the people compared to all the other life forms on Mother Earth, who, in my way of thinking, every other life form has just as much right to life as we do. They matter just as much in the eyes of the Great Spirit. Yet in our anthropocentric worldview, which is common to pretty much all of these religions, humanity is somehow on this pedestal, far above the next highest being, which would be down several notches, and then we glorify ourselves with vast godlike qualities of intelligence, the I word. We've created civilization. We're progressing down the road towards who knows what. But implicit in our worldview is our superiority to all other life forms. And I think that that's a very grievous error, a very misnavigated path that we've been going down for a really long time. So part of the show is about our understanding of what we believe is actually going on in the world. So a big part of that is whatever you allow to go into your mind is how your sense of reality is formed. And we've all got our day-to-day experience, our own personal reality that we've had, that we live and experience our day-to-day life and our memories of this lifetime. But so much of our beliefs about what's going on in the world comes to us from other people, other sources of information. In the world of today, heavily industrialized institutions whose purpose is to give us the impression that we're being informed by relevant, accurate, and meaningful information. But the bottom line is they're really just corporations selling a product, and whose goal ultimately is to make money for the people who own the corporation. And the bottom line of all that entails. So all the worldview building information that we bring into ourselves, especially from mainstream media, it's designed to make us think we're being informed by the most accurate and relevant information, but that's really not the case. And there's a very wide spectrum of dynamic factors involved in how this science of engineering public perception, the mind management scenario, I've covered it under the infotoxin hypothesis. So the science of how people manipulate each other's perception of reality is something I've talked about quite a bit and have been researching ever since the early 1980s. And especially in the world of today, the whole thing of climate change as it's being purveyed in mass media is the most ultimate example of the highest deployment of the whole infotoxin hypothesis that I've ever seen. For example, just last night I watched part one of a recent David Attenborough BBC series called Our Planet. And it makes me feel like that this film or this series of films is really just sort of the next generation of Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. But it's much more subtle, because just using images of nature, it's telling the story of the mainstream climate change hypothesis without even saying so. It's all about how the world is heating up, everything's melting, everything's drying out, all the animals are going extinct, and everything's being disrupted, and it's only started happening in the past 50 years, and now it's just accelerating, and it's just running out of control. And it's all just so bogus to me that anybody could actually buy all this. And sure, there are elements of truth to it, which is one of the key techniques that the mind control people use. Truth is our weapon. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is that we all have our worldview, and because a lot of people aren't motivated, or they don't have the time or the motive or the interest in constantly expanding and refining their worldview, they tend to have a worldview that consists mainly of the combination of just their day-to-day life, which is probably fairly routine and constant from day to day, from week to week, month to month, and year to year. And added in on top of that is the standard diet of mass media consumption. And so this creates a uniformity or homogeneity between the mentality of most people. And people are comfortable with that. They have a consensus reality that they share with their friends, and the apple carts never get rocked until I come along. And it's just sort of like a status quo. But Eric Fromm, the psychologist, defined this as the pathology of normalcy. And that's another show I'm working on. It's sort of like the pathology of normalcy revisited in the world of today, as opposed to the 1950s when he wrote his landmark book. But a big part of our big picture awareness, part of it would come from the effort that we're willing to put out to constantly expand and refine what we think of as reality, opportunities that present themselves or that we experience in order to, for example, meet interesting people or read interesting books or come into the contact with the work of brilliant researchers in different areas and stuff. And also our willingness to accept the possibility of realities that go against the grain of this consensus status quo. For example, the climate change thing, that brings me into conflict with people all the time. And so a lot of people refuse to accept the fact that our psyches have been being manipulated by other people for a long time. And this goes far beyond just advertising trying to convince you to buy a certain brand of toothpaste or drive a certain type of car. It's much deeper than that, creating entire ideologies. And it's very much akin to what you'd call black magic, in the sense of manipulating people against their will. And I mean, it's a given that if someone doesn't know you're manipulating them, then it's not, they haven't given you permission, so therefore it's against their will to manipulate people. And so a big part of what I do and what investigative research and journalism is all about, and the true spirit of education and sharing, is exactly the opposite of that. It's not trying to manipulate people or convince people or persuade people to believe anything or to buy anything or to do anything. It's to think for yourself, to be clear and open-minded. And a big part of that, it revolves around an understanding of your own internal psychological processes. So if we don't go to the work and trouble and attention of creating our own worldview, our reality is going to be largely consisting of that which we've assimilated from other people. And this reminds me of my very favorite quote from the Irish visionary poet, writer, artist from the 18th century. His name was William Blake, B-L-A-K-E. He said, "I must create a system or be enslaved by another man's." And I think he was really talking about sort of religious and political ideologies, but it's so true. If you don't create your own reality, you're going to be the victim of someone else's, especially in the world of today, when the whole predatory relationship between people and groups of people is more salient now than ever. If you're not actively creating your own worldview, you're going to be in danger of being enslaved by someone else's. But what I'm trying to get to is that when I look around at the beauty and power of nature, I'm constantly witness to human destructiveness just about everywhere you turn. And it's partly a matter of value judgment, but again, it's an example of what I'm talking about. Some people look at cities and skyscrapers and the military-industrial complex and rockets into space and nuclear submarines and the mining industry, all this, to this mentality, it's called progress. It's various manifestations of what we call civilization. But we're not creating a life. Or if we are, we're creating a life that's mutated. So we're actually, all of this, everything that we call civilization that's based on engineering the natural world, the transforming of the body of Mother Earth and her precious substances into artifacts and technologies and waste products, the violation of the Hopi prophecy, if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. I see this everywhere I look, and it's clear. I mean, ask anybody. Well, if you ask anybody how, if humanity is destructive, they'll go, well, yes, of course. It's almost like it's our nature to be destructive. And it's almost like there's a certain gratuitous element to it, too, that a large part of humanity seems to like to destroy life for its own sake. For example, the whole thing of hunters and poaching, and trophy hunters and stuff, and people that aren't going out to shoot an animal to eat it. They're going out because they want to just see it dead, and they want to mount it up in their living room in their multi-million dollar holiday home. I've never been able to fathom that reality of mentality. It's horrific enough for people to go out and hunt animals to eat them, even fish, but to just do it for no reason at all. So I think even everything that modern man does is based on sort of an inharmonious and destructive relationship with Mother Earth and our fellow beings, the body of Mother Earth, all the kingdoms of life. And part of our mentality is, and that some of this is rooted in some fundamental religious ideologies, is that these religious ideologies tell us that we're superior, that all the other plants and animals and Mother Earth was put here for us. And it's just the most ultimate anthropocentric delusion that I could possibly think of. So not only is it important to question all these assumptions that we sort of live by, but also to constantly try to expand your worldview to include a more realistic appraisal of the effect that our species is having on Mother Earth. And this is where someone like me, my eyes and ears are actually of great value, in the sense, not about so much me myself, but because I'm somebody that is a traveler who lives on the road, and I'm always in a variety of different places. A lot of times I go back to places I love, that I've spent a lot of time at, that I know at different times of year. My favorite places, like Great Barrier Island, New Zealand, different parts of Tasmania. And I'm really able to see how things change. And it's usually not for the better. You see more buildings going up, more trees being chopped down, more species of life being endangered. But when you do live on the road and you're constantly in different places, A, you don't have a chance to habituate or to sink down into a rut or a routine. And when you habituate to circumstance, you become sort of oblivious to what it is that's really going on. Everything becomes invisible. If you see the same things every day, day after day after day, you don't really see them anymore. And so whenever everything's constantly fresh and new and changing, you're always much more acutely aware of actually being able to perceive and see what it is right in front of you. So I'm sort of at a level of constantly maintaining that motion and that ability to be more aware of actually what's around me. And I would say that just through what we call the commonly accepted ideas of progress and the economic imperatives of growth and sales and business and marketing and stuff like that, that our destructiveness on the earth is increasing. And then there's a lot of stuff that I deal with in my work, especially with the health of Mother Ocean and the whales and dolphins. A lot of the whole, anything involving the militaries, like the U.S. Navy or any of the other branches, it's like we've been conditioned to not even perceive the existence of this whole juggernaut. But this is the single biggest sort of industrial enterprise on the planet, the largest destroyer of nature, the largest polluter and consumer of hydrocarbons and resources, and the creation of toxic waste. And this is not even in wartime. This is just by its sheer existence. And my friend Terry Lilly, the marine biologist, has written extensively about how everywhere the U.S. Navy goes, everything just dies. And that's really true. And this is even if it's not actually conducting war. It's just from being there, from all the chemical and electromagnetic microwave toxicity coming out. So what we call progress is progress towards, I'm not sure what. There's a beautiful little honeybee right down below me on my pen. And he's checking it out. I hope he's okay. He's probably just having a little break from collecting some honey. So if we expand our horizons of identity to include not just our own self, not just our body, and not even just our own family, but and not even just our species, all of humanity. We have a hard enough trouble doing that, but if we were able to include as I, all of life, the little honeybee, he actually just flew away, and the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees and the moon up above and the stars and the comets and the asteroids and the lavender and the bamboo and the rocks and the water and the clouds. If we include this, if we identify with all this, then A, we become much more inclusive beings, and then B, we actually achieve a higher degree of immortality, because nature has been around for a long time and always will be. And I think that even with the vast amount of destructiveness that my species is wreaking right now, we're not going to destroy life. We're hurting her. But now I'm getting to the real point of the show. It's, to me, the real danger of the current scenario is not even the horrific destructiveness that we're wreaking on all of life and the planet through a million different things that we're doing. That's bad enough, but worse than the actual destructiveness is the spiritual desecration that we're not living and being as who we're really meant to be. We're not supposed to be the destroyers of Mother Earth. We're not supposed to be the world eaters or the spore bearers or the Homo sapien macrovirus, which are concepts Lauren Isley, the naturalist, wrote two chapters in his book, The Star Thrower, called The World Eaters and the Spore Bearers. And these are sort of brutal evaluations of the true nature of humanity as a life form. And he said that of all his decades of studying nature, that the form of life that we most closely seem to resemble is the cellular slime mold, Myxomycophyta, which spreads out over the floor of the forest, and it gradually consumes all the organic matter within a certain radius. And then when everything's eaten up, it forms these fruiting bodies that all sort of flow back into one big blob, kind of like slugs, forms a fruiting body, and then it sends out stalks with spores. And then these spores go all through the forest and all around on the wind to start this process again somewhere else. And he likened our going into space to be very much like this. So it's our desecration of our sacred relationship with life that I think is the true danger of the world of today. And the spiritual consequences of this desecration are completely unknown to us. And because, just like we're only in the very beginning stages of beginning of an understanding of what all the synthetic, chemical, and radiological mutagens that we've created are doing, we're also in the very early stages of this very willful and highly technologically advanced destruction and desecration scenario, that its roots began 5,000 years ago, but it's really just sort of peeking out now. We don't really understand what we're doing to ourselves spiritually, much less physiologically or physically or biomedically. But I think that the spiritual consequences are even more profound and more serious and more concerning or disconcerting than the physical. And that's very, very horrific because, for example, I think Mother Earth is a very beautiful, powerful, intelligent being. A planet. There's no way that we can actually understand the psyche or the mentality, the beingness of a planet, a planetary being who's been here for billions of years and who has given birth to all of life as we know her, including us. And we're like the newest life form that exists, just about. So how can we, A, elevate ourselves to the pinnacle of everything that's ever lived on this planet, when the reality is, B, that we've been here a lesser amount of time than anybody else. So we would have less knowledge, wisdom, experience, and memory to draw on than any other species that have been here. So this is part of one of the vast contradictions that we have to resolve. In the words of Adlai Stevenson, who originally came up with the concept of Spaceship Earth in his brilliant 1963 statement. So I think it's so important for us to realize you don't have to be religious to have a spiritual orientation, but there's a lot more than us in the universe. Humanity is not, well, in a sense, we are the measure of all things because we exist as us. And so without a gargantuan effort to transcend our own limitations, of which a big part is just actually being aware of these limitations, but if you're not making a huge effort to transcend our own limitations, then of course we're automatically going to be the measure of everything. But it's a distortion. It's like looking through a lens where everything is shaped like a person. That's what we see. We define everything in terms of ourselves. And so to try to shift out of this mentality, to try to be aware, for example, of how the birds and the bees and all the life forms that are endangered, how they experience us, it's a big part of my work. And a lot of this has to do with, for example, I'm using language right now to communicate with you, a verbal spoken language, a symbolic Western Indo-European language called English. I'm using it because it works. It's not the ultimate map. It's not the reality that I'm talking about, but if you're listening to me, you can sort of understand what it is that I'm trying to say, which is the important thing, because that means communication is happening, an effective and understandable sharing of meaning, relevant ideas and concepts. If communication is happening, then the way that it's happening may not matter all that much. But it's not the ultimate reality. Like the linguist Korzybski said, the map is not the territory. We're in constant danger of confusing our linguistic maps with the actual territory. But the territory is astronomically vaster and more complex. And so we tend to, just for the sake of convenience and the lack of the reality management software capacity to handle reality, we're much more adept and accustomed to manipulating our maps and symbols. Sort of like, you know, we'd rather pre-digest the soundbite of somebody telling us what to think rather than spending a few weeks or hours doing your own research to try to get a picture yourself of what the actual ideas and generalized knowledge base for any given topic might be. That's another part of the work that I do, is taking the time to research all this stuff so that I'm not a victim of being enslaved by another man's reality. But I think that any little thing that we can do to honor the preciousness and sacredness of life, whether it's a plant or an animal, is a great step towards alleviating the desecration that our species is sort of slapping Mother Earth in the face with. And so much of it's everybody does their part. You know, like the automobile is bad enough, and that's an unquestioned, very destructive thing that almost everybody participates in, including myself. I'm very lucky to be able to drive here and there. But you've always got the danger of hitting wildlife, of wasting the hydrocarbons, of generating noise, of the possibility of accidents. So almost all the stuff we take for granted has a lot of negative ecological and spiritual impacts. So if we were able to live simply so that others may simply live, we could just, if we just cut down on everything that we do and prune it down and pare it down to the ultimate essential necessities, that would be a big step towards alleviating the destruction and the desecration. But to be aware of this is the first step. So the Hopi prophecy, as I've talked about many, 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 many times before, tells us what I believe to be true, that our desecration and destructiveness is so far advanced and so entrenched that there's nothing we can do to avert the cleansing that Mother Earth and the universe is going to bring down in order to guarantee that life herself is able to continue to survive. But she's going to have to get rid of the vast majority of everything that humanity is and is doing and is all about right now, because it's so far out of tune with life and the health of all the other life forms, including us. It just can't keep going on. Joseph Wood Crutch, the environmentalist, said that in his book, The Voice of the Desert, man has become the greatest tyrant that the earth has ever seen. So a big part of this is in what we're able to or willing to hold in the register of our minds and our attention. If you're constantly aware that so much of what we take for granted is actually a spiritual desecration, we're supposed to be the caretakers of life, the guardians of Mother Earth, the Kaitiakis and the Maori, the Kaitiakis of Mother Earth and of Mother Ocean. We're supposed to be nurturing and taking care of all of our life forms, not killing and enslaving, driving them to the brink of extinction. And so many life forms, like there's a big thing going around now, a million species of life are going to go extinct. And sure, that could be true. And some people go, well, but isn't that just natural? Don't all species of life go extinct? Or, it's a shame, isn't it, that climate change is doing this? And I go like, I just don't know where to start with all this sometimes. But the bottom line is, it's obvious to anybody with a brain that works, our species is wreaking massive destruction. And we're not showing any sign of pulling back. We're not lifting our foot. We're not taking the pedal up from the metal. We're putting it down further. And so due to technological advances, I don't think we could stop this destruction even if we wanted to. And I think it's going to be done for us. And my belief is that the destructiveness of humanity is going to be terminated by some kind of cataclysm, catastrophe of extraterrestrial origin, possibly an impact with a comet or asteroid that's going to take out so much of life in what we call civilization. But that's the only way that it can happen, because it's a sort of like so much of our industrial civilization, it's very much like a planetary tumor, like a cancerous growth on the surface of the earth, like cities. They aren't really alive. They're these non-living patterns that are sort of teeming with the corpuscles of people flowing through there. But it's just, it's really ugly. And how much of this there is, and how rapidly things are transforming in New Zealand and Australia right now. The mining industry, the construction, and the implementation of all this new electronic communications technology like the 5G and the ever invisible yet ever ubiquitous nuclear scenario is all just going off the rail. And not only are we destructive of life, we're desecrating our own true spiritual nature. So, in the Bible it says, man was made in the image of God. And I think that there's a degree of truth to that. That wasn't, if we read it in Hebrew, it might be quite different, but God to me is the beautiful, infinitely loving and creative spirit of the universe that's beyond anything we can comprehend. But her spirit has to do with the beauty and power of being here now, and the beauty of all the life forms that we are able to share Mother Earth with, the beauty we see in ourselves and each other. And if we honor this truth and beauty through how we live, not just what we say, but through what we do and what we also don't do, this is a very, very powerful step towards trying to become the people of one heart, the people who are still living on the path of the Great Spirit, and who the Hopi say will all find each other and come together and somehow manage to be in the right place at the right time when the proverbial shit does hit the fan, so that some of us and some of the people of one heart of all the kingdoms of life, not necessarily people, might be preserved and taken care of so that they can be the seeds of the new creation. And that was one of the highest compliments I've ever had when Barbara Randall, who was the widow of Uncle Bob Randall, one of the custodians of Uluru, when I was meeting with her a couple of years ago, she said, Jeff, you're actually painting the new dreaming. And so that is just such an honor for me to be participating in this process of bringing down the ancient sacred connection with water-based life that I think that the whole indigenous people of Australia, that their culture and their long-standing relationship with the forces of life and the Dreamtime ancestors and the whales and dolphins. This is so important, and I'm so honored to be a part of this process. Anyway, that's enough for me for now. I've got to get back and do some painting. Please be sure to live simply so that others may simply live. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off from Central Tasmania. Goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you. Anti-Media Radio, your host Nick Burnaby here on UCY.TV.